Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, it's been a record hot winter in Flagstaff, too, and it's hurting its reputation as Arizona's winter playground. And the new artistic director of Ballet Arizona took over after the long and influential run of Eve Anderson, how she'll make her mark. But first, the election for the board of the Salt River Project is normally very quiet. It's an off-cycle election in the middle of April with a relatively archaic voting model that allows only property owners to even vote. But it certainly wasn't quiet this time around. Yesterday, lines of hundreds of people stretched down the block at the SRP Voting Center in Tempe. The utility said early voting was three times what it was in 2024. And a lot of that has to do with the involvement of Turning Point USA. The Charlie Kirk-founded conservative action organization made a point to get involved in the SRP election this year in a big way and went up against environmental groups working to move the utility closer to a clean energy future. Preliminary results are expected today. We're watching now for those. And Jared McDonald Evoit joins us to talk more about it. He's been following this all, and he's with the Arizona Mirror. Good morning, Jared.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. Okay, so, I mean, have you ever seen this kind of interest in an SRP election?
No. Typically, we see a turnout of around 5% in these elections.
Wow.
And so this is pretty unprecedented.
Right. Okay. And tell us more about how these elections work. I've seen headlines calling them bizarre of late. I mentioned that they're based on property ownership, but it's really not even that straightforward, right?
Yeah, only eligible landowners who actively request a ballot will receive one in these elections. And generally, it's the way it works is it's not a one person, one vote sort of situation. If you own land in SRP territory, you do get to vote, but your vote depends on the number of acres that you own. So say you have 20 acres, that's 20 votes. The number of acres you have is about the number of votes that you get in the election.
And that means that there are some landowners, property owners in this area who get a lot of votes, right?
Correct.
Okay. So let's talk about Turning Point USA here and their involvement in this race this time around. They backed a slate of mostly incumbents in the race. Why did they say that they decided to campaign so heavily for an election that is, you know, pretty obscure?
So Turning Point, which is, as you point out, the conservative political group that was founded by the late Charlie Kirk, they've come out because the big issue that is at the heart of this election is clean energy. And one side is saying that this is really advocating for continued clean energy use in the state. And the other side is saying, no, we need to not have this kind of continued focus on clean energy, and that would be the Turning Point USA side. Their kind of claim is that we need to move away from renewable energies in order to move to different energies. And the big argument on that is because of data centers, because that we have a big boom on data centers. And so each side is kind of saying that their side has the better idea for how we're going to tackle the upcoming energy that is going to be needed for these data centers that are coming to our state.
Right, right. I mean, and this is, I've seen signs around the valley for this. There's been some money poured into this race. Some major environmental advocacy groups got involved on the other side. We saw Jane Fonda talking about this, right?
Correct. The other side has had, a major influx of money from environmental groups that have the backing of Jane Fonda. Their slate had big wins, you know, in previous elections. And so Turning Point has this year been estimated that they are likely to outspend the other side, though, by 10 to 1. But we don't exactly have a good idea of the spending quite yet. We haven't seen many releases on the spending on either side yet.
Okay. Okay. You broke a story earlier this week, Jared, about some of the ballot collection tactics from Turning Point USA in this election. We should say they're legal what they're doing in this election, collecting ballots and turning them in. But it's a practice that Turning Point and other conservatives have criticized in the past when Democratic groups were doing it, right?
Correct. Arizona made the act of ballot collection, which has kind of pejoratively been referred to as ballot harvesting.
Right.
by conservatives and groups like Turning Point USA in 2016. But there is a carve out in state law that was created in 2016 for special elections by special taxing districts like SRP. Turning Point USA has put a lot of effort on this election to do a lot of ballot collection. And Turning Point in the past has been very vocal in their opposition to the act of ballot harvesting. Kind of, they've promoted a lot of conspiracy theories in regards to the ballot harvesting is a vector for, you know, widespread fraud. They promoted, you know, films like 2000 Mules, which was an attempt to prove that ballot collection was a vector for fraud in elections, mm-hmm. even though that film was widely debunked and those allegations have been largely discredited.
Okay. So let's talk about what we're looking at now. We've seen the board at SRP been kind of not taken over, but there have been more clean energy advocates kind of slowly making incremental strides to gain power on that SRP board for some time now. So what are the candidates on the slate now? How likely is it that more of them might, you know, be able to take a seat given this election or this campaign against them from Turning Point?
Well, to be honest, it's unclear as of right now. I mean, we had record turnout yesterday. We saw that some of the there was a good number of people coming out yesterday in the line saying that they came out because of the Turning Point USA kind of action in this race. And then we saw a lot of people coming out yesterday. They were saying they were coming out because of Turning Point, you know, to support against and for it. I mean, we saw, I think that the Turning Point's involvement kind of galvanized both sides, the aisle on this issue. So it's hard to tell who is going to come out on top until we see these results start pouring in.
Yeah. Water rates are going up, Jared. There's a lot of concern about our state's water future in particular. And of course, this is part of what the utility does. How influential could the results of this be in regulating? I mean, what is one of the state's largest utilities? Like, if clean energy advocates are successful or not here, how much could it really sway what ends up happening on that front?
This is going to be incredibly influential. Utility estimates are, you know, for the next several years. I mean, we're looking at demand is going to grow by around 4% per year between 2023 and 2035 is one of the estimates. And that's large in part due to things like data centers and also urban sprawl and also the increase of the adoption of things like electric vehicles. So we're looking at seeing whoever is going to be controlling this board is going to have a big influence over what our rates are going to be and how we're going to react to this new energy demand that we're seeing, not just in Arizona, but across the country.
Yeah. And of course, data centers, water rates, all a part of that bigger picture going forward.
Correct.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Jared McDonald, Evoy, following this story for the Arizona Mirror. Results will be coming later today. You can find them on our website. Jared, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Last week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced that the headquarters of the U.S. Forest Service will move from Washington, D.C. to Salt Lake City, Utah. President Trump's administration will also close research facilities in 31 states as part of the organizational overhaul. Proponents say moving the headquarters west of the Mississippi is a way to move leadership closer to where the majority of national forest system land exists. Opponents, though, say that the agency's headquarters should be in the nation's capital, where federal policy is made. Our next guest is Jim Pattiz, co-founder of More Than Just Parks. He spent over a decade writing about America's public lands. He sees the changes as an attempt to gut the Forest Service. As he recently told my co-host Sam Dingman, he thinks the administration's choice of Utah as the service's new home is part of that plan.
They're frankly in cahoots with the state of Utah. A couple weeks ago, I reported on a partnership agreement that they signed. The chief of the Forest Service, who is also a logging executive, signed with the governor of Utah. It gives the state unprecedented control into the Forest Service's operations within the state of Utah. You know, this is a state that is actively suing the federal government to take control of 18 million acres of our public lands. So when the federal government, when you're being sued by the state of Utah and the federal government is then signing these partnership agreements and now moving the Forest Service's headquarters to the state of Utah, that sends a pretty clear signal, I think.
Another key shift here is that the Forest Service's regional offices are being closed and replaced with state directors who are going to be embedded at the state capitals in 15 states. Why is that change significant? Because, you know, as I say that out loud, some people are thinking that that sounds somewhat bureaucratic, but you're saying it's actually a really big deal.
Yeah, it's significant for a couple of reasons. Number one, and the kind of the most obvious, the Trump administration has been doing this, even going back to the first Trump administration. When you close the regional offices and then they're basically creating these state directors out of whole cloth, that basically eliminates all of the leadership at these regional offices and then allows you to appoint your own political appointees as these state directors. The regional offices, in addition to the DC headquarters, this is where so much institutional knowledge is concentrated, particularly in leadership. These are all the leadership positions of the Forest Service, and basically they're going to be gone. They're going to be eliminated, either literally eliminated, or in most cases, it will be a situation where they're told, hey, you have to move to this office in Salt Lake or this new office in this other state or, you know, this other place. And they're not going to uproot their family. Usually when you're in a leadership position like that, you're already at a point where you can retire. And so they're not going to do that. You know, they're either going to take a different job or they're going to take retirement. But then the other main point here is that these state directors, as you point out, they're embedded in the state capitals. These new state directors are going to be basically embedded with these state governments, and these directors are going to be at their beck and call. And that's not at all how the Forest Service should operate. This should be something, these are federal lands. They're not lands that belong to the state. Moving, you know, the Forest Service headquarters to Utah moves you, you know, 2,000 miles away from the accountability that, you know, you need to have in Washington, D.C., and it moves you very close to those state-level lobbyists.
So there's some arguably sleight of hand happening here, right, where they can say that by making the state-level directors proximal to state governments, there's empowerment, but it's actually disempowering to take the headquarters out of D.C., which is where the actual Forest Service policy is being decided.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And you're disempowering Americans.
So the precedent for this was in Trump's first term when he moved the headquarters of the Bureau of Land Management from D.C. to Grand Junction, Colorado, which, among other things, was a very small town, not close to a major airport, which obviously had implications for staff making decisions about their futures. What happened when the Trump administration made that move that you see as predictive in terms of what we're likely to see here?
87% of the affected BLM workforce left. They separated from the agency rather than moving to Grand Junction. And
wow.
Of course they did.
Right.
You know, you can't uproot people like that and expect them to just go over there. And the Trump administration knew that. They can claim, you know, all kinds of things about getting it closer to land. The entire point of that move was to get rid of all of this institutional knowledge and to be able to replace people with their own pliable political appointees, people who we're going to rubber stamp more extraction. And, you know, so that's exactly what happened with the BLM. But the Forest Service, what people need to understand is, you know, this is on a much, much larger scale. This is affecting so many more people. The Forest Service is a much larger agency than the BLM.
Yes. As you point out in the piece, we're talking about, I think it's 193 million acres of land.
Yep.
The other major impact here, as you write about, Jim, is the effect this is going to have on research projects.
Mm-hmm. I want to point out that the Forest Service Research and Development Program is the largest forestry research organization on the planet. Our Forest Service research and development program is the envy of the world. I mean, generations of institutional knowledge, incredibly long-running studies, and they have, you know, in many cases, they do what are called experimental forests. And so they're testing all kinds of ways to bring back habitat or restore watersheds or whatever it is. And they're shuttering most of these experimental forests and these research stations. And you can't pack that up and bring it. And they know that. The Trump administration knows that. But the purpose of this is to stifle that research so that we can't make informed decisions when people want to make developments on Forest Service land, whether that's a mine or whether it's logging activities or, you know, any other kind of development activities, oil and gas, you name it. They won't be able to point to bodies of research or even conduct the necessary research to say, hey, wait, you know, that's going to have a negative impact on this area. There won't be anybody left to do it.
Speaking of that, one of the things you argue in the piece is that a lot of these moves are being made to create a kind of a pretext, right? The idea being that they close up these operations that we've been talking about, shut down projects that cannot be relocated, which then creates a window in some undetermined period of time for them to say, well, what is the Forest Service really doing? It seems like they're not getting anything done. We should, in fact, curtail it even further.
Absolutely. And that's what I feel like that, you know, this was laid out in Project 2025. This is what the Trump administration, you know, on a smaller scale tried to do in the first term. And now they, you know, it's like it's on steroids. But yeah, this is the objective, whether it's the Forest Service or any number of federal agencies that they don't like. It's to shrink the agency, basically to hollow out the agency, and then to point at it and say, you know, look, this agency's no good anyway. They're not working, and tell the American people, you know what? The private sector can do this a whole lot better.
Well, I have been speaking with Jim Pattiz, who is the co-founder of the website More Than Just Parks, where he has been reporting on this. Jim, thank you for this conversation.
Thanks, Sam.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, for the artistic director of Ballet Arizona, curating a season is a delicate balance of trying to sell tickets and trying to take the institution to the next level.
The quality of our dancers is excellent. So that means we can perform very high quality, high profile choreographers. By bringing these choreographers here, which I already have started doing, you start to create awareness, because they go away and they talk. You know, they're like, yeah, I was just with Ballet Arizona and it was great. And the dancers are fantastic. And they did my work really well.
We'll hear how she plans to take the company from hidden gem to internationally renowned. But first, in all of our reporting on drought and the heat in the Southwest, have you ever thought, man, it'd be nice if we could just make it rain right now? We really need some rain. Well, as you may or may not know, we actually can do that. It is called cloud seeding, and it's being used here in Arizona and in states across the West to literally make clouds rain or snow, but we'll get into that in a moment. The question is, how much water can it add to our increasingly dry climate? Could it, for example, make a dent in the water supply headed to the Colorado River as negotiators continue to fail to make a deal to conserve the river's water supply and threaten our collective water future? For some insights on those questions and more, I'm joined by KJZZ's Alex Hager, who covers water for us. Good morning there, Alex.
Good morning, Lauren.
All right. So let's begin, Alex, with just an explainer. Like, how does cloud seeding work? There are two different kinds.
Yeah. If there is one thing to know about cloud seeding, it is that it does not make water. It basically just helps it fall from the sky. I'll tell you what I mean. So there's cold weather cloud seeding, and that is where you take tiny particles of a substance called silver iodide and you shoot them into clouds that already exist. And then there's water in those clouds, and it's kind of not ready to fall. It's not condensing yet, But once you add that silver iodide, it gives something for the water to bunch up around, and then it gets heavy, and then it falls as snow, usually in the mountains at high elevation. Then we also have warm weather cloud seeding, which is pretty similar. You know, that one, you usually have a station based on the ground, and instead of silver iodide, it's sending up an electrical charge into the air. That also causes water inside clouds to condense and then get heavy enough to fall as rain.
Okay, so kind of surprisingly simple. How well does it work, Alex? Like, is there data on that big question of just how much water this could make come down from these clouds?
Yeah, it is really simple. We are starting to get data on how much water it can make. A lot of what we're going to be seeing now and in the next few years is coming from Utah. They have the biggest, best-funded cloud seeding program in the country. They have more than 200 stations that try to make snowfall in the mountains. The state says it is able to boost annual snow totals by about 6 to 12%.
Okay, so a range and, you know, not a huge amount, but some. Okay, what about that other big question then, Alex? Like, could cloud seeding help us address the big problem we're looking at here in the West right now, which is the water supply in the Colorado River, which is really in dire straits right now?
That is the big question. Even in Arizona, when we're thinking about the impact of cloud seeding, it is probably going to have more to do with the cloud seeding that is done very far away from here in the snowy mountains of Colorado and Utah and Wyoming because of the Colorado River. That river supplies more than 6 million people in our state, and more than 80% of the river's water starts as snow. So every year when we're thinking about how much Colorado River water will come to the valley, will come to farms in the Yuma area, we are thinking about how much snow is falling in those high-altitude mountains. And right now, the management of the Colorado River is a big question mark. We're in the middle of ongoing negotiations about its future. It seems that the states that have to decide who gets how much are just stuck in those talks, and there are big questions about how much each state is going to get going forward because there is not enough to go around under the current rules. And this is something that people are looking to as maybe a way to tweak how much there is to go around.
Right. Maybe a little bit. Okay. So if we've got a relatively simple technology here that can make clouds rain where we need them to rain, even if it isn't a ton of rain, I have to ask, like, why isn't this more widely used?
So I've seen two main reasons come up. One is the fact that it isn't really adding water. It's just telling it where to fall. And because we are in a drought, that means across the West, a lot of times there is just less moisture in the air. So there's less time that cloud seeding can be effective. Even if you have the infrastructure and have the money to do it, if there aren't clouds, it's not going to work.
Not going to work on a sunny day.
Exactly. The other big thing is that we don't actually have that much data on how effective it is.
Okay.
We're starting to get more out of these big trials in Utah and elsewhere in the West. But even though the technology has existed since the 1940s, the really good data that can guide how we're using it in this century really didn't start coming out until 2018. And the research that did start coming out then made it hard to tell how much cloud seeding was actually adding to the snow that falls naturally. It's just really hard to measure. You know, if you can only add snow when it is already snowing, it can be difficult to quantify exactly how much of that was a direct result of cloud seeding.
Okay. So what are the drawbacks here? Like, are there environmental concerns? Like, how much is it that we do not know?
Right now, there do not appear to be big, screaming, obvious drawbacks. When it comes to safety, you know, proponents of cloud seeding say we actually do have pretty good data on how safe it is. So even when you have silver iodide entering the water atmosphere, it is way clear of the level that the EPA considers safe for drinking. Right now, the biggest question is just getting better information about how much water cloud seeding can actually add. But, you know, our region is getting so dry. It is a problem for so many people across the Southwest. Yeah. Policymakers are kind of just throwing the kitchen sink at this problem, and this is part of the kitchen sink. You know, there's one Colorado River negotiator who often says, look, we're not going to fix the water problem with a silver bullet, but we might be able to fix it with silver buckshot. And in my opinion, I think cloud seeding could be part of that silver buckshot.
Okay, part of the bigger picture. There are stories, Alex, once in a while about whether or not cloud seeding leads to flooding. Like, this came up at the state legislature here in Arizona when there was historic flooding in Globe, right? Like, what are the safeguards?
Yeah, cloud seeding programs generally do not get off the ground without the state permitting and regulating them. And part of that regulation is really strict guardrails specifically designed to stop cloud seeding from making flooding worse. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of those regulations say, look, if a huge storm is on the way, you've just got to shut off the cloud seeding gear, make sure it's not contributing to a too much water problem. That seems to be the case in Globe. You generally see the effects of cloud seeding show up within a really short time period, maybe half an hour. And the cloud seeding near Globe ended 4 days before that big flooding there. Mm. Also, at the end of the day, cloud seeding experts say the technology just can't add huge quantities of water. And the amount that it would take to cause big flooding anywhere, that's something that generally only naturally occurring rainstorms are really capable of producing.
Okay. Are there efforts here in Arizona to fund this then, to fund cloud seeding? It sounds like there is cloud seeding happening here in our state.
And there has been for a while. You know, different agencies have dabbled in cloud seeding going back to the 1940s, kind of on and off over the decades. One of the best recent examples we have is there was a big trial program in Pinal County last summer. The numbers are a little fuzzy, but Pinal County thinks it added about half an inch of rain over 3 months. One of the big conclusions that came out of Pinal County is that it added water for incredibly cheap. Mm. So the experts who ran that study said it cost about $3 to add an acre foot of water. That's the unit we usually use to measure water in rivers and reservoirs. So $3 for 1 acre foot. Now, by comparison, if you wanted to generate 1 acre foot of desalinated ocean water, that would cost you multiple $1,000s. It costs multiple $1,000s per acre foot to build a bigger dam to capture more runoff. So because it is so cheap by comparison, and water managers are kind of looking everywhere for every solution they can get, I expect we will probably see some more cloud seeding in the future.
Wow. Okay. Alex Hager, KJZZ's water reporter, joining us. Alex, thanks so much.
Always good to be here.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Winter in Phoenix never looks like a snow playground, but that's why so many of us head north up the I-17 to Flagstaff when the weather turns cold for some skiing, snowshoeing, sledding, etc. Winter tourism is one of Flagstaff's most important economic drivers. In fact, in the 2022-23 snow season, an estimated 167,000 people brought $19.7 million to the local economy. But this season, it's been a tougher sell to get people to visit Flagstaff's snowy peaks because, like much of the Mountain West, there just hasn't been much snow. Flagstaff just saw its highest temperature March in history, with just 26.6 inches of snow by the end of the month. It tied for the third driest snowfall month in Flagstaff history. That's 58 inches behind normal for this time of year, according to the Arizona Daily Sun. I spoke more about the impact of that unwintry weather earlier this morning with Trace Ward, executive director of Discover Flagstaff, the city's official convention and visitor bureau.
We've had other winters that we've had less snowfall than our average. So it isn't entirely new, but I will tell you that, yes, everybody in the community was waiting with bated breath for the snow. Mm-hmm. It's very important to us. It's important for both our economy, as well as it's important, that snowfall is important for the state. So, yeah, it's disappointing we didn't get the snow that we wanted, but we certainly pivot like we do every year when this occurs.
Yeah. So let's talk about that, what this looks like. I mean, you can't control the weather, obviously, and we were experiencing a similar kind of parallel narrative here in the Valley, right, in terms of spring training and all of these big events happening and record high temperatures throughout the spring here. As you were watching the snowfall totals run short, the temperatures remain high in Flagstaff, did you see impacts on tourism, on visitation? Because so many people go up to ski, to sled, to play in the snow, right?
Yeah, we did. We were down about 2% as an aggregate for the winter season, which is not nothing, but perhaps less than what some people might think in this scenario. Yeah, so it has a lot to do with the fact that Flagstaff's a dynamic city. It's not just a ski town. We have lots of industry and lots of things for visitors to do, even if they don't want to Well, even if they can't play in the snow, so to speak.
Right.
But we do have some of the key drivers for winter, which are Snow Bowl, as well as the Winter Park sledding area, which is at Fort Tut Hill. Mm-hmm. So they make snow. I'm sure most of the listeners know that. So they had a not quite a par year, but the fact that they can make snow certainly helps.
Yeah, I can imagine. So 2%, not huge, but not nothing, as you're saying there. What did this look like for businesses? I mean, this is 2% of a very big pie, right?
Right. Yeah. Our restaurants are reporting that their patronage could be as high as 60-70% in some cases of their business. So when tourism is down, it's a big deal for them. And yeah, the restaurants and some of the shops had a slow year, a tough year for sure. So, you know, we just market all of the other things that there are to do here. The Lowell Observatory has a new astronomy discovery center, you know, charming downtown with lots of unique restaurants and shops. And of course, you know, Route 66 is having their centennial this year. So we're seeing more of a what we call a medium or a long haul customer coming in for that, mm-hmm. less of a drive market. And then there's just Museum of Northern Arizona and, of course, award-winning breweries. And quite honestly, people just want a really cool mountain town getaway. And so even if they don't have the snow, we get those visitors that just want to be at 7,000 feet.
Yeah. So, I mean, lots of stories have been coming out of like Colorado and Utah this year about those ski resorts having very rough years. And Flagstaff isn't quite that kind of, you know, exclusively ski resort town. But it does sound like this could be more common going forward, whether or not it's our quote unquote new normal to have very high temperature winters, much less snow as we did this year. I mean, is this something that Flagstaff and the Tourism Bureau in particular there are thinking about in terms of, you know, a more common scenario, at least in the future?
Yeah, the city adopted a climate action plan not too many years ago, and they're working towards carbon neutrality, which is the goal is 2030. And we participate in that goal. So the city takes climate action very seriously. We do anticipate that this could be approaching the norm as time moves on. Yeah. And in those cases, we're really just, like I said, selling what we have. I can't create the snow in the city. And so we're going to talk about all the beautiful trails that we have, all of the cool attractions that we have in the city, and just a really great mountain getaway. So we have to pivot. We don't have a choice in those cases, mm-hmm. but we don't know for sure how fast approaching that is. So we just take it year by year.
Take it year by year, yeah. So in terms of the city looking at a climate action plan going forward, is there a sense there in Flagstaff that you're going to have to rebrand, rethink, you know, it'll be a little bit of a different kind of attraction? Maybe not, you know, Phoenix's winter playground, but at least a getaway from the heat.
Well, you know, we are a Four Seasons destination. So the branding, even with climate change, doesn't really evolve that much for most of the seasons. In the wintertime, it would evolve somewhat, but always remember that, you know, the mountain skiing starts at 9,500 feet. And with their snowmaking ability, the skiing is probably here, you know, maybe not quite as good as we'd like it, not as much natural snow, but it's here you know, for a long, long while, longer yeah. than we're going to be around. So.
Okay. Trace Ward, Executive Director of Discover Flagstaff, the official convention and visitor bureau for the city up there, joining us to talk about this warm winter. Trace, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Ballet Arizona announced its new season last week with a combination of traditional shows that will bring in the crowds and innovative new works that, as artistic director Daniela Cardim described it to me, push the art form forward. It's the company's 40th anniversary and Cardim's second year at the helm. She took over after the long and storied career of dancer, choreographer, and artistic director Ebe Anderson, who left Ballet Arizona in 2024 after 24 years in the role. Cardim is an internationally celebrated dancer and choreographer herself, most recently at the New English Ballet Theatre in London. But a native of Rio de Janeiro, she's choreographed and danced all over the world. And so when I sat down with her in her office recently, I had to ask her, why Phoenix, Arizona, of all places?
I really loved living in Europe, but I just felt, you know, when you feel like a cycle and your life is kind of ending, and I just kind of felt that that was the case. I really wanted to direct a company. I was co-director in the UK of a smaller company, and I was choreographing a lot. But I just felt it was time to move on, and it was kind of an intuition almost, but I felt that the opportunity was in the US. Mm-hmm. And then I started looking and I saw this position when this position opened, and I was like, I started researching about the company. I kind of knew the company had a good reputation, but I started looking more into it and I thought, perfect size, really good position, you know, a strong history, and started looking into Phoenix. And, you know, I never been in the desert, to be honest. But I grew up in a very warm country. I grew up in Brazil. So that felt attractive to me. So yeah, I started looking and I was like, why not?
Has it been a bit of a cultural adventure, if not a professional one as well?
A little bit, but not actually. I don't know. I'm one of those people, I adapt really well wherever I go. So I lived in four different countries and I can see the good things and the bad things everywhere. And you just have to look for the things you like and the things that you can connect with.
So I want to ask about what you've been able to do so far in the year, almost 2 years here that you've been here already, and what your vision looks like for the future. Like in terms of programming, what's your philosophy? Like, I know you have talked about wanting to bring back some of the classics that brought people to the ballet, you know, traditionally, but you also choreograph yourself as well. How do you envision the mix of what you would like this company to do in the future?
So there are a few things that are important for me. So first of all, we are a classical ballet company. We have the duty to keep presenting classical ballet from the classical canon. Yeah. So we started the season with The Sleeping Beauty. And The Sleeping Beauty, it's a 100-plus-year-old ballet, you know, very traditional, very beautiful. And it needs to be performed very faithful to the original. So there my seasons probably will always have something that is very classical. And if one season doesn't, then the next one will for sure. Because this is part of what we have to do. Now, next to that, I also like to bring work that is new or tell new stories or tell stories in a different way, right? So this year we did Alice in Wonderland. And Alice is not such a new story, but it's a new ballet, actually. The ballet was created, I think, 20-something years ago by Septime Webb. It is a story ballet. It is still very family-friendly, but it's very modern in a way, like the way that he choreographed and the way the production is and the design. And then we have our programs. There are more we call the contemporary ballet programs. And these are fun to program because usually they are triple bill, we call. So they're three different smaller ballets in one night. And for me, it's nice to give like a range. So this year we're doing something from the classical ballet, which is the Balanchine, all the way to the contemporary ballet, which is Cacti. So then in that program, again, is balance.
Is part of that a marketing strategy today? Because it's such a difficult time to attract people to the traditional arts or really to get people to come out to anything anymore. I wonder how you think about that, how you think about attracting and bringing in new audiences, which, I mean, every company in the country and the world is going to have to be doing right now.
Yes, for sure. We have to consider that. That's one element. So again, is about balance. So the mixed bills, typically, they are much harder to sell, to attract audiences because it's not a story. People don't necessarily know what they're going to come and see. However, we have to keep doing it because those are the ballets that you could say, you know, push the art form forward. It's what keeps us alive. It's what keeps us modern and current.
That's interesting. So you think about it in both ways. I wonder, as you're looking at trying to program these things and trying to, you know, make sure that you can sell seats, but also push the art form forward, you've said that your goal here is to turn the ballet into, you know, an internationally renowned top company in the country. Is this how you think you do it? Like that kind of balance? Is it about who you bring in? Is it about your dancers, your principals? Is it about the programming more? What do you think it needs?
So it's a combination of things. I think we are a little bit of a hidden Jew in the desert, if you will. But the quality of our dancers is excellent. So that means we can perform very high quality, high profile choreographers. Mm-hmm. By bringing these choreographers here, which I already have started doing, you start to create awareness because they go away and they talk. You know, they're like, yeah, I was just with Ballet Arizona and it was great. And the dancers are fantastic and they did my work really well. And that's kind of how you like grow reputation. So this is a little bit of my strategy as well, is bringing a lot of national and international top choreographers and top works. I call them masterpieces, right? First to expose that to the Phoenix audiences because they deserve to see amazing things, but also for our dancers to have the opportunity to work with these people and for these people to see how amazing our company is.
Do you plan on choreographing some originals while you're here as well?
I do, but that's not my priority. I really love curating a program and a season. And as I balance the season, there are so many great works that I want to bring that I actually kind of left myself as like, it's okay, I can do it next year, you know. I'm here anyway. Mm-hmm. So I'm choreographing, like, restaging some of the classics. So this year I restaged the Sleeping Beauty. Next year I'm going to restage Don Quixote. And then further down the line, I will eventually choreograph an original work for the company. But that's not my priority. I don't see myself as a director choreographer. Mm-hmm. I see myself as a director first. And I happen to be a choreographer as well.
So let me ask you about that role and how you view the role of artistic director in general. You're coming into Ballet Arizona after, you know, the long run of Ebe Anderson, who made such a mark here, was so influential. I mean, what's it been like and how do you envision your role as somebody coming in with probably a different perspective?
Sure. So with Ebe Anderson being here for so long, he obviously built the company to what the company is today. So I am very grateful for his work because really we are only here and have what we have today thanks to his vision. Of course, every artistic director has different strengths and different areas that they like to focus on. He was a great choreographer, is a great choreographer, and the company did a lot of his works. As I now have this position, I shift slightly the focus away from the director choreographer, as I just said, mm-hmm. but more about, like, let's get more of a variety of choreographers. It's about refreshing, right? So how can I bring something new? What is it that I have that can be different and useful and interesting for the audience? And next season, we will be doing Ibe Anderson's Romeo and Juliet, mm-hmm. which I'm very, very happy because his legacy really is part of this company's history.
So it sounds like you view the role as almost maybe behind the scenes as opposed to, you know, making your own mark.
Yes, I suppose. I mean, I think I make my own mark by the quality and the innovation that we put on stage. You know, I teach company class sometimes. I work with the dancers directly, but also making sure that artistically we are in a very healthy environment, work environment is very important for me. So making sure that culturally we are a good place to work, that's also a huge part of my work.
Daniela, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Daniela Cardim is the new artistic director of Ballet Arizona. And you can learn more about their new season on our website, theshow.kjzz.org. And that'll that'll do it for today's edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. And don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show, and you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads at theshow.kjzz.org. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, and Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.